Hi guys, welcome to the annual carnivorous plants display. This is Isabel, your tour guide today, and let's explore carnivorous plants together. First, let's flip to the first page of the big album. The carnivorous plants are representative of the kingdom Plantae, the division Anthophyta, and are located in both classes dicot and monocot, span 6 orders, 9 families, and 595 species. They provide interesting examples of plant morphology and environmental adaptations. Talking about adaptation and evolution, let's turn to the next page of the album. So what evolutionary forces push these plants toward a taste for meat? The evolution of carnivorous plants is obscured by the paucity of their fossil record. Very few fossils have been found because carnivorous plants generally do not form readily fossilable structures, such as thick bark or wood. Still, it is widely believed that carnivory evolved as a method to increase nutrients in extremely nutrient-poor conditions. Carnivorous plants clearly benefit from eating animals, but the benefits of eating flesh are not the ones you might expect. Why does carnivorous plants need energy from the sun while also consuming other organisms? To solve that mystery, let's flip to the next page. Unlike carnivorous animals who use carbon in the protein and the fat in meat to build muscles and store energy, carnivorous plants instead draw nitrogen, phosphorus, and other critical nutrients from their prey in order to build light-harvesting enzymes to do photosynthesis. Eating animals, in other words, let carnivorous plants do what all plants do, grow by grabbing energy directly from the sun. But because they have to use a lot of energy to make the equipment they need to catch animals, and the lack of flat solar panels, carnivorous plants turn out to be very inefficient at converting sunlight into tissue. Therefore, only under special conditions do the benefits of carnivory outweigh the cost. They typically thrive in places with poor soils, but with abundant water and sunlight. The poor soil of bogs, for example, offers little nitrogen and phosphorus, so carnivorous plants enjoy an advantage there over plants that obtain these nutrients by more conventional means. Bogs are also flooded with sunshine, so even an efficient carnivorous plant can carry out enough photosynthesis to survive. They are stuck, but they are making the best of it. Okay, let's talk about traps, which basically make these carnivorous plants who they are today. Flip to the next page of the album and pick out a note sheet that you are going to fill out as we go along. Are you ready? So traps work in three different ways, major. First, pitfall traps. Pitfall traps trap prey in a road leaf that contains a pool of digestive enzymes of bacteria. The two pitcher plants in Station A would be a perfect example of pitfall traps. And while I'm introducing them, go ahead and to observe them, sketch them, touch them, and take pictures of them. So let's look at these two pitcher plants, which rely on a pool of water to trap the prey. It has a most unusual leaf that first looks like a normal leaf, then develops a tendril at its tip, and finally the tip of the tendril develops an amazing pitcher. It gains support by twining the tendril around another plant. The trap lures its prey into the pitfall traps by a combination of decaying odors and sometimes a red coloration. As the pitcher develops, it swells and droops due to its weight. As the pitcher matures, it suddenly begins inflated with air. Once inflated, it begins to fill with liquid, then opens, revealing the enticing interior. The top of the trap has a lid that initially covers the pitcher until growth is complete. When the leaf is fully grown, the lid opens and the trap is ready. They attract insects with the odor of nectar. By the way, talking about attracting insects, feel free to feed them with a box in the container on the table. Once inside, the insect finds it cannot get a grip on the walls of the pitcher because a flaky wax on the interior surface peels off as the insect struggles to climb. Eventually, it falls into the water and struggles to escape. The motion caused by struggle stimulates digestive glands to release a digestive acid. This acid is so strong that the meat will disappear within hours. You know, the largest of this, the Raja pitcher, is able to digest mice. So let's move to the next station. Snap traps which utilize rapid leaf movements to draw prey. Let's look at these two Venus flytrap in station B. The leaves of Venus flytrap open wide, and on them are short stiff hairs called trigger or sensitive hairs. When anything touches these hairs enough to bend them, the two lobes of the leaves snap shut, trapping whatever is inside. The trap will shut in less than a second. The trap doesn't close all the way at first. It is thought that it stays open for a few seconds in order to allow very small insects to escape, because they wouldn't provide enough food. The trap will reopen in about 12 hours and spit it out. When the trap closes over food, the cilia finger-like projections keep larger insects inside. Fold your hand together, lacing your fingers to see what the trap looks like. In a few minutes, the trap will shut tightly and form an airtight seal in order to keep the digestive fluids inside and bacteria out. If an insect is too large, it will stick out of the trap. This allows bacteria and molds on the insect to thrive. Eventually, the trap turns black, rots, and falls off. The trap constricts tightly around the insect and secretes digestive juices, much like those in your stomach. It dissolves the soft inner parts of the insect, but not the tough outer parts called the exoskeleton. At the end of the digestive process, which takes from 5 to 12 days, the trap reabsorbs the digestive fluid and then reopens. The leftover parts of the insect, the exoskeleton, blow away in the wind or are washed away by the trap. If you feed a Venus flytrap something that doesn't move like a dead insect, it will not close tightly over it. You need to squeeze the trap and move the food around so it imitates the action of a live insect. The lobe manufactures digestive juices and an antiseptic juice. This keeps the insect from decaying over the few days it is in the trap and purifies the prey that it captures. Now, let's move to the next station. Flypaper trap, which utilize sticky mucilage to draw prey. The sundew on station C would be a perfect embodiment of flypaper trap. Same, while I'm talking, go ahead to observe them and feed them if you are brave enough. The master of sticky flypaper, sundew, is a slow trap compared to the one in Venus flytrap. The sundews are so named because their glandular leaf hairs glisten like dew in the sun. The leaves of sundews are covered with tentacles. The tip of every tentacle contains a nectar gland, which produces a globule of sticky digestive enzymes. When an insect lands on the leaf, they get stuck on the dew. As they struggle to get out of the dew, the tentacles start to wrap around the insect. The dew eventually suffocates the insect, and it stops moving. The digestive enzymes absorb nutrients that the sundew needs. Now, let's go back to the album where we've left and turn to the next page. These carnivorous plants are amazing, aren't they? Unfortunately, the adaptations that enable carnivorous plants to thrive in marginal habitats also make them exquisitely sensitive to environmental changes. Agricultural runoff and pollution from power plants, the black market trade, poaching, and disappearing habitats are all threatening their existence. Good news perhaps for flies, but a loss for all who delight in the sheet inventiveness of evolution. Now talk to your friends about any ideas to save these plants. If you could, write them down on the idea packet in the album. Finally, don't forget to scan the QR code of the table to quiz yourself on what we've learned. Thank you all for spending time with me. Looking forward to seeing you all next year.